I'm Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, a globe-spanning hunt for alternatives to synthetic materials that can be taken sustainably from wilderness. We'll spend this hour with writer Edward Posnett, who got interested first in the harvesting of eiderdown in Iceland, where landowners protect these Arctic ducks while they're nesting in exchange for the ability to gather the down they leave behind when they migrate, which sells for many thousands of dollars in finished goods like jackets and bedding. As we'll hear in his stories from Malaysia, Indonesia, and Sardinia, the symbiosis is rarely perfect, but it does prove there are ways to draw from nature without destroying it. Our conversation starts after a short break.
Funding for the Think podcast comes from TCU, where researchers strive to develop sustainable solutions to protect the world's fresh water supply. You can learn more at endeavors.tcu.edu.
Before there were natural history museums, there were Wunderkammers. The term means something like wonder closet, a cabinet where collectors of curiosities from the natural world could display and protect their array of interesting things, unusual shells, seeds, eggs, horns, fibers gathered from around the world. These days, most of our possessions are man-made or significantly processed from plastics to polyester. But there are still natural wonders to be found. And the ones Edward Posnett finds the most interesting are those that can be harvested from the wild without destroying it. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Posnett's own Wunderkammer is his new book of essays about places in the world where people gather things that can only be produced by nature, things like eiderdown, bird's nest, sea silk, and civet coffee. The book is called Strange Harvests, The Hidden Histories of Seven Natural Objects. Posnett joins us from the studios of the BBC in London to talk about it. Ed, welcome to Think.
Thanks so much for having me.
So you say the original Wunderkammers represented not just travel, but like expanding knowledge about the world and the connections between people and places and objects. Was there one collection historically that you were particularly drawn to?
Gosh, yes. So I initially fell in love with the story of a Danish collector called Ole Worm. I'm not entirely sure if I'm pronouncing his name correctly. And he was a Danish physician from the 17th century, and he traveled widely and gathered an array of objects, which he wrote back about in a wonderful catalogue. And in his catalogue, you can also see a visual representation and image of his collection. And what particularly interested me about this collector was the way in which he was interested in touch. So not only did he write about where these objects came from and tried to speculate on what they could tell us about the natural world, but he was also really curious to hold them in his hands, to feel their textures, and to really start from touch as a way to learn about the world. And I'm quite a tactile person, and I just thought this idea was wonderful.
So help me understand how you moved from a career in finance to one that allowed you to sort of begin to build your own metaphorical Wunderkammer.
It's quite a curious transition in some ways. So after university, I took a job working for a professional services firm in Canary Wharf, which is one of London's two financial centres. And actually, I was working as a writer, surrounded by financial technicians, accountants and consultants, etc. And my job was to write about companies and markets. And I often found myself writing about goods and objects, but at quite a high level, so not really engaging with what was going on the ground. And I think I felt a little bit alienated. There wasn't really much texture to what I was doing. And I packed that job in and started doing various things, volunteering in a homeless shelter, doing a bit of teaching on the side. And I came across a story which I thought was just absolutely enchanting. I visited an artificial wetlands in London, very close to the Thames, called the London Wetland Centre. And there you can find all sorts of birds, many of which are not native to London at all. And I saw some eiders, which are very large sea ducks. And I learnt there about how their down is harvested. And I thought the story was so wonderful that it just filled me full of enthusiasm, and enthusiasm that I hadn't felt for quite a long time. An enthusiasm that was not only tied to the way in which the down was harvested, the stories of symbiosis, but also the object itself. And I found a connection with this object, with eiderdown, which is this wonderfully light, beautiful down, in a way that I'd never felt a connection with any of the other objects that I'd written about in the city. And I started gathering other objects, and I suppose used some of the skills that I had learnt about in the financial world to write about and investigate totally different things. Hmm. So that was the transition.
So the collection of eiderdown, the way it's done in Iceland, really is remarkable. You describe Icelanders and these wild ducks as equal partners in this venture. Explain that.
Yes, in a sense they are equal partners, and I think this is quite exceptional when it comes to our relationship with the natural world. So what happens is that every summer, lots of these large sea ducks, they come to the Icelandic coast in their thousands, and they nest. And they build their nests by plucking down from their breasts. And this down is an incredibly lightweight insulator. It's very, very soft. And they craft these wonderful nests, and I describe them as looking a little bit like a furry omelet. And they lay these their eggs into these nests. And what the Icelanders do is they gather this particular down from the nest. Some of them take it before the ducklings have hatched. Others prefer to wait until the ducklings have left. They then process it and turn it into a beautiful, wonderful finished product. And what intrigues me about the method of gathering down is, you know, when you think about the fibers or feathers that surround us, most of these things come from dead animals. They're byproducts of the meat industry. Hmm. And actually, in the case of eiderdown, the ducks aren't harmed at all. And actually, there's evidence to suggest the opposite, that actually the ducks have benefited because Iceland has such large populations of eiders. Because what the Icelanders actually do is they protect the ducks from their predators, such as Arctic foxes or gulls, and they often spend all night long. I say night, actually, during the summer months, there isn't really much in the way of nighttime. So they protect these ducks. And as a result, something rather curious has happened, and that over centuries, because this has been going on for so long, the ducks somehow know instinctively that they will receive protection. So they tend to nest quite close to human settlements, almost like domesticated fowl. And it's a very sort of curious sight seeing these wild creatures next to Icelandic farms. So that's what I mean by equal partners.
So you met up with a pastor who protects ducks on and around his property as they nest, and he's one of the ones who prefers to wait until they move on to gather what down they leave behind. How does he do that? How does he find where these nests have been?
Well, in his case, it's not terribly complicated. So he owns a large piece of land in the Westfjords, which is a very remote region. I mean, a lot of Iceland is quite remote, but the Westfjords is particularly remote. And actually, because harvesting has happened for so long on his land, the ducks really come to him, and he just has to sit back every year and not scare them off. It's a sort of bizarre form of rent collection. and he protects them. And he, you know, he's a sensitive kind of guy, and he doesn't want to disturb the ducks. So instead of taking some of the down while it's fresh, because the down is so lightweight, it actually rots quite quickly. So a lot of eiderdown farmers want to get it as soon as possible. But he prefers to wait, and instead of taking it, replacing it with straw, he will wait until the ducks have gone, and then gather it himself, and then sell it on to an intermediary.
There is some irony at work in this system of taking only what the animals naturally produce and not killing the ducks for their down. tell us a little more about what's required to make Iceland safe for eiders.
That's right. So initially when I read about eiderdown, it seemed to be this wonderfully idealistic story of cooperation and balance. But actually, when I went to Iceland, you realize that the reason why this special relationship exists and that ducks love the Icelanders so much is that the Icelanders do quite a lot of killing on their behalf. So they hunt their predators, they shoot foxes, they kill gulls, and even on occasion, not now but in the past, they've killed these beautiful creatures, Icelandic sea eagles. And I think sea eagles may even have been in danger of going extinct some decades ago, possibly perhaps because of the activities of eiderdown farmers, although some would dispute that. So you're right, there is a certain paradox or irony here in that the Icelanders are being virtuous in a certain sense and favouring one species, but there are other species which are paying the price. And I think the most sensitive farmers who I met understood this balance. They understood the killing of foxes to be a necessary evil. I should say that the Icelanders have historically had quite a bloody relationship with the Arctic fox and have really sought to control their populations since the settlement period. I think the most sensitive farmers know that they shouldn't go too far, and that if they do go too far, then they create a kind of monoculture whereby only the ducks survive.
Here's the thing that really surprises me. Actual eiderdown, you know, like I have pillows stuffed with, I don't know, goose feathers and pigeon feathers and who knows what, but actual eiderdown costs a fortune. It's surprising that no one has tried to, like, raise these things on farms by the thousands and harvest down that way.
I mean, you're right, and it is surprising, particularly when you look at so many of the other examples in my book, where actually often harvesters or entrepreneurs are tempted to use intensive techniques, farming, the use of cages or fences, etc. In the case of eiders, I simply don't think it would work, and I did raise this question with certain harvesters. I think the main reason why the Icelanders wouldn't do it is because eiders are a sacred bird and have been protected for a long time. So actually, the idea of an Icelander doing any harm to one of these wonderful creatures is quite hard to fathom. The second reason is that actually, on a practical level, I don't think it would work because eiders need to be out in the open ocean to get their food, and I think it would be extremely difficult to farm these creatures. I don't really want to go into any of the details, but Icelanders have told me quite flat out that it's not really a possibility there.
In fact, Scotland tried to, like, establish itself as an alternate site of eiderdown production. It didn't work out.
That's right, yeah. So I wouldn't say Scotland necessarily did, but there was one individual, very charismatic nature writer, naturalist called Gavin Maxwell, who had this rather enchanting idea of trying to replicate Icelandic practices on the Scottish coast. And he drew up all sorts of plans and schemes. And indeed, I looked at his private papers, and there's an incredible volume of material there. And he spotted about 30 pairs of ducks, because you do find eiders off the coast of Scotland, and he imagined that he would be able to draw them in their thousands. And he went to Iceland and spoke with ornithologists and harvesters and tried to learn the Icelanders' secrets. And he actually was convinced that the way that the Icelanders drew these ducks was through objects, because sometimes Icelanders will put up flags and coloured objects, believing, I think almost mystically, that they somehow attract the ducks. And so Maxwell put up lots of these objects, windmills and flags, etc. He even thought about trying to feed the ducks with mussels and trying to play them music. It was quite an eccentric and entertaining character. And unfortunately, it didn't really work out. And I don't know whether that's necessarily down to Maxwell's own inability. I think anyone would find it very difficult off the coast of Scotland, because there isn't that historical relationship, and there just aren't a sufficient number of eiders. That said, if anyone, you know, is thinking about trying it, I wouldn't necessarily want to put them off.
My guest is writer Edward Postnett. We're talking about his new book, Strange Harvests: The Hidden Histories of Seven Natural Objects. You're listening to Think. Frank. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest is writer Edward Posnett. We're talking about his new book, Strange Harvest, The Hidden Histories of Seven Natural Objects. Okay, Ed, there's a delicacy in China known as bird's nest soup. What kind of nests are we talking about here? How are they constructed, and what kind of birds build them?
This may require some explanation. edible bird's nests, they are small nests produced by a bird called swiftlet. They are very small swifts that nest deep in caves throughout Southeast Asia. They're almost so small as to appear insects. And they nest in very great numbers in these caves. And they're perfectly adapted to the caves. It's really extraordinary. They can actually echolocate by emitting these clicks. And what they do is that they actually produce their nest by threading saliva against the cave wall. They have these special glands that produce this kind of mucus. And over a period of about 30 days or so, they form these wonderful half cups made of this mucus. And once they're dried, I'd almost describe them like sort of shrimp chips. they're quite curious to behold. Some species also add their own feathers, and I always thought it was very enchanting that birds could do this, because ordinarily, you think of most birds, they build nests from all sorts of materials, twigs, leaves, etc. And these birds build their nests entirely from themselves. So that's what those particular nests are. And of course, there's a very long history of human usage of these nests, which may surprise many.
Do we have any idea of who first had the idea to eat this bird's nest made out of special bird mucus?
It's a great mystery. No one really knows. I should first say that there is a long history of nest eating in China. We don't know exactly when it started, but I think the earliest reference dates to probably the 16th or the 17th century. Some people say it goes back much longer. There was a story I heard while I was in near this very, very large cave in Borneo. In the 19th century, someone had entered this cave and saw these nests and thought that they were actually mushrooms, and then had started taking them off the cave wall and then trading them. So perhaps someone thought initially that they were fungi and edible. I don't know. I've long speculated how it could be that someone could turn these nests into a foodstuff, because when you see them in the wild, it's quite hard to imagine putting one in your own mouth, mixing your own saliva with that of a bird. There's an ornithologist called Tom Harrison who thought they were better suited for furniture rather than food. So it's a mystery.
So you've tasted bird's nest soup, or maybe it's more accurate to say not tasted it, because you didn't think it had a lot of flavor.
I found it to be totally tasteless. And other people have said similar things, though often bird's nest soup, essentially a nest dissolved in water to form a broth. Some people add sugar to it and other flavorings, which obviously will change your experience of it. I think the attraction for many people might be more texture rather than taste. And I thought about this recently, because actually what happens when you dissolve these nests is the sort of hardened saliva goes back to its original gelatinous form. So you do get quite an interesting texture, and this may well be appealing to some people.
So how are these nests collected, and what consideration do harvesters give to the needs of birds who built them to live in these nests?
That's a really good question. I think actually follows on quite nicely from the previous question, that the attraction of these nests and why people value them, I think, is tied very much to the means in which they are traditionally harvested. So these birds' nests, often very high up in these enormous caves, and to reach them, traditionally, what people would do is erect very large ladders or poles, and they would climb up them in really sort of extraordinary feats of agility, and scrape the nests off using a scraper, which is essentially a piece of metal attached to to a stick, and the nests fall onto the cave floor and are gathered by other harvesters. They're then processed and cleaned to turn these nests into a foodstuff. It's incredibly dangerous, and people would often die trying to retrieve these nests. And it's very, very labor intensive. The other thing I should say is that this operation is often carried out in complete darkness, surrounded by birds, bats, pythons, and the guano produced by all of these creatures. And the harvesters who I spoke to seem very much at ease in these spaces, but to someone who's not used to it, it's quite terrifying and insalubrious.
Yeah, they invited you to go up with them, didn't they?
One harvester did, but I declined. I think maybe 10 years ago I would have tried it. You really need to be very gutsy to go up to these places. And actually, if you look at the bodies of harvesters, they're quite curious. I mean, to climb up these poles, you need extraordinary upper body strength. And actually, when you see people literally walking up poles, it's almost as if your view has been inverted, and they're just walking along a flat surface. They have such incredible strength, concentration. They're full of admiration, but didn't really want to try it myself. So that was the traditional method. There's a very different means of harvesting the nests today, which is also very interesting.
Yes, cities are now trying to lure swiftlets into sort of, I guess, man-made or at least human facilitated nest areas.
That's right. It's an intriguing transition in the method of harvesting. What actually happened was that most nests did actually come from caves right up until the 1990s, when there was a massive boom in demand for swiftlet saliva, which was closely tied to rising incomes in China, China's transition from communism to state capitalism. And these nests really became a status symbol and were sought by the middle classes, really as a symbol of luxury. And as a result, many caves, in fact, most caves, unfortunately, were totally ransacked. Bird populations plummeted. And the story didn't end there, because rather canny entrepreneurs in Indonesia, what they did is they started building artificial structures, a little bit like hives. They converted houses to try and attract these birds, and they used different techniques, such as playing artificial birdsong, electronic birdsong. And they built these structures to try and imitate the conditions of caves, and they proved phenomenally successful. So they have attracted large numbers of birds, and now many people are in on the act, building these hives all over Southeast Asia, basically anywhere where you can find the birds, because the nests are so valuable. It's a rather intriguing structure, which in some ways resembles beehives, so the birds are free to go and to enter and go as they wish, and the harvesters have to be quite careful not to take too many nests, lest they frighten the birds away.
So perhaps the strangest prized substance that you write about here is civet coffee. Some people might have heard of this, but if not, will you explain what civet coffee is?
Sure. So civets are nocturnal cat-like creatures, which you actually find all over the world, but the civets I looked at, the palm civets, you find in Southeast Asia. And it's said, or the legend, is that these civets have a particular knack for finding the best quality coffee cherries in the wild, on which they gorge. And it's also said that once these cherries have passed through their digestive system, they become flavored with their enzymes and digestive juices, and actually make for very good coffee. And actually, civet coffee in some parts of the world is considered to be a great delicacy, and is harvested. My understanding is that initially it was carried out by local people in Indonesia during the period of Dutch colonization. Today, civet coffee is more of a global commodity, and I don't think there's much local consumption. And it has, unfortunately, a rather dark history behind it. It was once vaunted as a sustainable trade, whereby harvesters would go out and gather civet scats sustainably. But actually, the truth is far darker than that.
So what happens to civets now?
It's a rather depressing and sad story. So in the 1990s, a coffee trader took some of this civet coffee from Indonesia or Thailand, and he publicized it as a curiosity. And it elicited a lot of interest, I think, because of the rather curious way in which it's actually harvested. And as a result, there was a boom in demand for this particular object. I mean, in some ways, it was similar to the boom in demand for bird's nests. And what happened was that harvesters found a way to essentially intensively farm these creatures. Instead of harvesting these scats out in the wild, what they did was they started putting civets in cages and force feeding them or simply feeding them coffee cherries, and then just removing their scats from the cage and forming a small cottage industry.
So you've tasted civet coffee. Is it as remarkable as it's purported to be?
I didn't think so. And I'm no coffee expert. It certainly had a flavor, but when I tried it, I wrote that it was quite indistinguishable from the cheap coffee that I had had in my old office job. I think there's little that's remarkable about it, but I'm sure you would find a coffee expert who would agree. In any case, regardless of what it tastes like, I think the experience is probably ruined by the knowledge of where exactly it comes from. And I suppose one of the important things that I wanted to emphasize in this particular chapter is that if you're interested in buying civet coffee, you should probably think again, because most of it, in fact, I would say probably 95% of it, doesn't come from the wild, as is purported on the packet, but actually comes from caged creatures.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. All right, let's talk about sea silk. This is something I honestly had never heard of before I picked up your book. What is sea silk?
So sea silk is a rather wondrous marine fiber, which is produced by very large bivalves, mollusks that you find throughout the Mediterranean. And they can often grow to be, I think, about a meter in height or so. And what they do is that to root themselves to the sea floor, they secrete a liquid protein which hardens on contact with water. It's quite a remarkable substance. And essentially this protein, this filament, acts as a root. And since antiquity, this fiber has actually been harvested and used for a variety of uses. It's been used to make fabrics or clothing. And once it's cleaned, it has this remarkable golden sheen to it. It's a little bit like golden horsehair. It's a very, very curious substance. And when you touch it, it's almost impossible to conceive that it could come from the ocean. You almost would imagine that it's produced by an insect.
It is
a very large insect.
Yeah, it is exceptionally labor intensive to produce and work this stuff.
It is, yes. So traditionally what would happen is that these shells would be pulled from the sea floor, and they're pretty firmly rooted, so divers would have to go down and dislodge them from the sea floor, or fishermen would have a special tong which they would use to pull them up. Then they would have to cut off the sea silk itself, and then clean it and process it to turn it into a workable fiber. And I imagine it's a process that, you know, would have taken days, if not weeks. Incredibly labor intensive, requires a huge amount of patience.
Why are there so few people now who even know what to do with it, or are sort of claiming to know what to do with it?
Well, I think the first answer I can give is that it's quite hard to know exactly what the utility of sea silk is. It's a very beautiful thing, but actually it's extremely hard to use as a fiber. I think there were experiments in the 1920s or 1930s to try and use machinery to work with byssus, but actually it just ended up busting the machines. I mean, the main reason why there isn't really much sea silk and people don't really know about it that much, I suppose, is because it's actually protected that these shells are endangered, and there's actually EU legislation which really means it's you not only can you not harvest the byssus, you can't even actually touch these shells, so they're very closely protected.
What is it? You did touch the fiber because you met some people who had, they said, sea silk that had been harvested before the EU rules, right?
That's right, yes. So I did touch some byssus that was harvested, I believe, in the 1930s by a master weaver called Italo Diana, who's from Sant'Antioco, which is an island off the coast of Sardinia. And he ran a weaving school and actually did a lot of research into how you could harvest byssus and how you could use it to make tapestries and other objects. He was someone who experimented with it a lot. But you're right, actually, since the 2000s, it's actually very hard to get hold of byssus. So anyone who is offering you fresh byssus probably isn't getting it from a legal source.
Did you find yourself wanting to own samples of all the things that you studied on this trip?
Definitely, constantly. I think I've always loved objects from the natural world. I've loved their textures and the stories behind them. And I think what really drew me to these objects was the fact that not only did they come from nature, but also they had passed through so many pairs of hands, that they were part of culture and part of nature at the same time and didn't really belong to any particular category. So I really wanted to collect the raw materials, actually, rather than the finished objects. And I have a few of them. I have a bird's nest and I have a little bit of eiderdown. But many of them are actually subject to export restrictions in their raw state. So that was, unfortunately, a barrier to me putting together an enormous Wunderkammer.
My guest is writer Edward Posnet. His new book is called Strange Harvests, The Hidden Histories of Seven Natural Objects. We'll be back to the conversation in 2 minutes. Chris Boyd speaking with writer Edward Posnet about his new book, Strange Harvests, The Hidden Histories of Seven Natural Objects. And I have to tell you, I loved the chapter about vicuña fiber because the idea that this valuable thing that is probably more expensive than anything I will ever own, but it's possessed by wild animals and pretty much only by wild animals, right?
That's right. Yeah, it's so a vicuña is a wild camelid. It's the wild cousin of the alpaca and the llama, the domesticated animals of South America. And it has an incredibly fine fiber, which has this wonderful cinnamon color. And it's a beautiful substance to behold, very, very lightweight and an excellent insulator, because these creatures live in the high altiplano, sometimes as high as 4,000 meters. And communities in Peru, reimagining an old Incan tradition, have managed to shear these creatures, obtaining their fiber without killing them. And in the same way that I was intrigued by eiderdown, I was also intrigued by vicuña fiber, because again, most of the fiber that surrounds us comes from either dead animals or domesticated animals. And this fiber comes from a creature which may well still be alive somewhere in the Andes. And I always thought that was rather remarkable.
So what's involved in rounding up these animals when it's time to shear them? And how traumatic is that for the animal?
It's a totally mad exercise. I think, shearing sheep is hard enough. What you need to imagine is shearing a wild creature, which can run up to 30 miles an hour at altitude. So it's very, very hard to do. And what happens is that typically you get large numbers of of local people from these communities in Peru who work together, and they essentially have a long rope which they stretch across the Altiplano or the Puna, and attached to this rope are flags, and they try and surround the creatures and flush them into a corral. And that was the sort of initial plan, which has taken place really since the 1990s, when it first became possible to shear these creatures. Since then, what's happened is that professional teams of shearers have really taken over in Peru. They carry out this operation in much smaller numbers. They tend to be extremely fit, like high altitude marathon runners. And they rely on a similar system of ropes and also erect some permanent structures as well. But it's extremely difficult to do, to round up these creatures. And then, of course, you have the shearing, which is even more complicated. It's hard enough to shear a domesticated creature. And what happens is that the shearers will go into a corral where there are lots of vicuñas, and they really grab them and try and restrain them in any way that they can. It's extremely difficult to do, and these creatures, at least when I visited, seemed not particularly happy about it. They were bucking frantically and trying to escape the grasps of the harvesters. And the creatures have to be tied down by ropes attached to stakes. They are often blindfolded. So it's extremely stressful. And actually, that was something that really struck me when I visited. And it's not really something that's easy to capture in words, because vicuñas are absolutely terrified of human beings, and indeed that's why they've flourished, or not flourished, but managed to survive. And there's some controversy about the effects of this particular roundup and shearing. Certainly it's not pleasant to watch. I did read a study that said it doesn't have a long-term effect on the creature's reproductive rate. But this is only when there are certain conditions that are met, and when the roundups are carried out at certain times.
Is it ultimately more brutal than, say, shearing a sheep?
I would say so, yes. I mean, the difference is that a sheep is a domesticated creature. It's often used to human contact. Vicuñas are very, very skittish. They don't like being close to humans. And in fact, when I was in Peru, I would try and follow vicuñas or get as close as I could to them, and it's very, very hard to do. I found I could only get within, maybe 50 meters of them before they ran off. So it is inevitably quite quite a stressful encounter when shearers restrain these creatures.
Some of the things you're describing here, I mean, it's wonderful that the animals don't necessarily have to be permanently harmed or killed and just sort of removed from the ecosystem. But we could just leave them alone, right? Something that some of these objects have in common is that they are like something that only very wealthy people can afford. Should we think twice about wanting these things from animals simply because they exist?
Certainly, yes. I mean, one thing I would say is that not all the objects I've written about are, in fact, luxury products. I also write about guano, which is a fertilizer used by Peruvian farmers and also Tawa. But I definitely take your point, and I think, yes, one should definitely think about this. I, to a certain extent, I feel comfortable with eiderdown. That is a long tradition that's taken place in Iceland, and I think when it's carried out correctly, does have certain benefit effects both for the species and indeed for local harvesters. But there are many examples in the book where this is not so clear cut. In the case of civets, which I mentioned earlier, these creatures are cages. That's clearly an awful thing, and you don't want to go anywhere near most civet coffee. The case of the vicuña, it's quite complicated, and I don't really take a fixed position on this. The reason why it's complicated is that vicuña numbers, since the chaco has been, by the chaco, I mean the system of roundups has been introduced, vicuña numbers have seriously increased, and they were actually in danger of extinction in the 1950s and the 1960s, and there was a concerted conservation effort, and a reserve was built in Peru called Pampas Galeras, and numbers recovered. Unfortunately, this reserve found itself in the middle of a civil war in the 1980s and really fell apart. And many people say that the reason why vicuña numbers today are so healthy is because local people are incentivized to protect them. It's not quite as simple as that. It's not just a good news story, because actually some people have started doing things like fencing vicuñas to try and increase their numbers and to make it easier to shear them and round them up. And this has effects for their genetic variability. But in the case of a vicuña, I suppose what I'm trying to get at is, yes, one could indeed leave them alone, and in some ways that would be the ideal situation, and emotionally that's the one that appeals to me the most. The reality is, in the case of the vicuña, is that if they were simply left alone, they might share the fate of other species, which haven't fared so well. And one of them is the huanaco, which is the wild cousin of the vicuña. And no one really wants to shear the fiber of the huanaco because it's so temperamental. It's even more aggressive than the vicuña. It's very large, and it also has slightly coarser hair, I believe. And in Peru, the huanaco is not faring well at all. So I've given you quite a long answer, but I feel quite torn in the case of the vicuña, and indeed many of the objects. Some of them are clear-cut, others not so much.
So you write about, I should say, you confess to being pretty fascinated by actual ivory as a kid, like if you'd go to someone's house and they had ivory objects. But you found something that is a vegetable product, something that grows, that is not so different. The properties of it are not so different than the properties of ivory. Tell us about that.
That's right. So tawa is this wonderful nut that comes from a palm that you find in northwestern South America, and it's extremely dense, this nut. It's almost about as dense as copper, and the amazing thing about it is that it really has the look and the texture of ivory, which is quite remarkable. And indeed, I'm told that actually it causes some confusion at customs, because officials actually struggle to distinguish it from ivory or hippopotamus teeth. And really up until the 1940s, the 1950s, tawa was incredibly useful in the economy, because it was used to make buttons. And in fact, if you go to a thrift store and find an old coat or an old jacket from before the Second World War, it may well have tawa buttons. And I always just found it really intriguing that buttons could be made from a seed, because today, of course, most of our buttons come from plastic. And some people have looked to tawa as a possible substitute for ivory. I think it's a little bit optimistic, in the same way that it's optimistic to say that it might be able to substitute for plastic. But nevertheless, it does possess this wonderful charm, and I think really bids us to ask questions about our relationship with nature. You know, maybe if we used tawa buttons instead of buttons made from different materials, it might mean there are more tawa palms in the world.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. So I don't want to finish our conversation without talking about guano. The guano trade has a pretty checkered history, not least because workers have often been abused in the collection of this fertilizer. You say in modern times, the Peruvian government has found a way for birds and men and one intrepid, no-nonsense woman to coexist on a very small island.
So that's right, yes. I mean, in the 19th century, there was a huge boom in demand for guano, which is essentially bird excrement, seabird excrement. It was an extremely valuable fertilizer, and really, I suppose, the world's first global fertilizer. And there were very large deposits of it on a series of islands off the coast of Peru, very, very large deposits, which reached, I think, you know, sometimes about 10 stories high. These deposits were ransacked, and the birds were scared off, and their populations plummeted. But what really intrigued me today was that actually the Peruvian government has found a way, has really sought to try and extract guano in a very different way, treating it as a renewable resource. And this initiative really dates back to the beginning of the 20th century, when the Peruvian government, in conjunction with various conservation officials, turned their attention to the rate at which living birds actually produce guano. So actually whether we could view guano as a renewable resource, and whether one could protect the birds and view them as really as valuable in and of themselves, because every year they replenish this valuable resource. And so the harvest actually takes place today, where hundreds of men and one or two very intrepid women go to these islands, these rainless and barren islands off the coast of Peru, and they extract guano. They dig it up and they put it into sacks, and it's transported to the Peruvian mainland, where it's used by Peruvian farmers. And it's a constant balancing act. And in the book, I sort of say that what they try and do is they try and imitate the logic of eiderdown. They try and protect the birds while also taking the guano, which is a very complicated thing, because essentially these islands are built of granite, but also guano. In a sense, when you remove guano, you're also disturbing the bird's habitat. But there's a lot of thought that goes into it. It isn't always managed correctly, and it's not always perfect. But I think, an example of certainly of cohabitation, because you have lots of people living on these islands very close to enormous bird populations.
This book made me think about the very selective amount of information that we tend to receive and, frankly, ask for when we buy something. We might hear what sort of fiber something is, or, you know, what an object is made of, but we don't tend to know much about its actual origins.
That's true, and I think it's really part of our current crisis that we don't know really about all the stories that go into objects that surround us. And that could be really, it could be eiderdown, but it could also be, I don't know, the plastic microphone in front of us. And the story that we receive is often condensed and, you know, is obviously used for marketing, and has little to do with the true nature of production. And I think in these chapters, what I wanted to do was to try and close that gap between, you know, a person who might buy or pick up a particular object and all the labor and all the stories that have gone into it. And the richness of these objects is that not only do they have human labor, but they also have non-human labor. But I suppose there's a reason why we're not surrounded by these stories, is that it sometimes makes small decisions quite complicated when you have all these narratives floating around you. But in some ways, I think we do need to plunge those depths and not come out in a state of paralysis, but one of reflection. And something I try and capture in the book. I don't know whether I manage.
The new book by Edward Posnet is called Strange Harvest: The Hidden Histories of Seven Natural Objects. Ed, it's been a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you very much for making time for us.
Thanks so much.
You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our handle is at KERA Think. We hope you know that you can use any podcast app to subscribe to the Think podcast and check out our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.